here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 6th of February. I'm Rohith Joseph.
And I'm Linda Young. You'll listen to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to the listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:06 and time for a full hour of independent campus local news. Today's top stories and segments are a radio essay by Elizabeth Holliday about Sexual Assault Awareness Month and the politics of rape culture.
We also have your AMS update by Maura Wapton, featuring an interview with AUS President Jana Omasi about the AMS student court.
Later in the program, Marco updates us on all of the newest science and tech news.
And for our final piece, we have an interview with Joy Lewis and James Cohen from Party Well, a UBC organization that is donating all proceeds from their events to building wells in Kenya. But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, UBC clinic recruiting sexually active gay men to change blood donor policies. On Wednesday, the Network Center for Applied Development, NETCAT, hosted a rainbow donor clinic here at UBC's Point Grey campus. Despite decades of being banned from giving blood, sexually active gay men were encouraged to donate blood for research purposes. Historically, gay men have been deferred or even banned from donating blood due to the perceived prevalence of HIV and hepatitis C within the gay community and fear that these diseases may be transferred to patients receiving a blood transfusion. In 2013, Canadian Blood Services were finally allowed to donate blood for medical use, so long as they have been sexually abstinent for 5 years. Many members of the gay community, including 30-year-old Chad Waters, felt this policy was wrong and discriminatory. Though official policy remains stacked against gay blood donors, the clinic hosted by NETCAT invited Chad Waters to donate blood for research purposes rather than medical transfusions. The Rainbow Donor Clinic is the only one of its kind in this world, and according to a senior development scientist and a Canadian Blood Services, Jason Aker, researchers' demand for the blood is only growing. When interviewed by The Globe and Mail, Mr. Waters said, quote, "Until I can give back to transfusions specifically, I can as well give back for research and development, potentially saving millions of lives." Researchers and activists alike are optimistic that further blood research will allow blood donors to be chosen based on empirically based types of blood rather than statistically prejudiced. The ultimate goal of NETCAT's blood research is to make blood transfusions safer and more effective for all donors and recipients. Chad Waters is leading efforts to recruit individuals who have been rejected from donating blood in the past, adding, quote, "If there's an interest to help by giving blood, NETCAT provides the space to do so."
In local news, BC Supreme Court decision throws Vancouver City Council into chaos. Last week, the BC Supreme Court rejected the City of Vancouver's approval of development permits and zoning changes that allowed the construction of two controversial residential towers in Yaletown. As part of his official verdict, Justice Mark McEwen wrote, quote, "The procedure the city adopted was unfairly restrictive in presenting the public with a package of technical material that was too opaque. The issues surrounding the two towers were initially raised by the Community Association of New Yaletown last summer. CANI members noted that one of the towers approved by Vancouver City Council was roughly five times the city's existing height and density limits for the area, arguing that this was a sign that the city was unfairly benefiting developers at the expense of residents. Developers Bren Hill Developments and the City of Vancouver made a deal to swap Bren Hill-owned property on Richard Street with the city-owned property in Yaletown, where Jubilee House currently stands. Jubilee House is an older building that contains 87 housing units for residents on veterans' pensions and welfare support. As part of the deal, Bren Hill would gain rights to redevelop Jubilee House for commercial sale. In exchange for building a 13-story building with 162 units to replace Jubilee House, Bren Hill was permitted to build a much taller building than the previous zoning allowed, 36 stories with 448 units, 110 of them guaranteed as market-rate rentals. In his verdict, Justice McEwen said, quote, "It is impossible to tell whether these numbers have a real-world justification or are simply used to give the appearance of adequate consideration." Vancouver residents were also surprised to discover that the Jubilee House property was estimated to be worth $15 million, while the Bren Hill-owned property was worth only $4.4 million. The deal was thus seen by CANI and other residents as a loss of nearly 50% in capital for Vancouver taxpayers. Bren Hill has also agreed to give the city $25 million in community amenity contributions. An email statement by Bren Hill on the court's ruling said, quote, "We're terribly disappointed with the way the court viewed the process, and that the decision has now halted a project already under construction." In response to the ruling, city planners have been frantically taking action to save the construction on the two Yaletown towers and have been seeking the public approval necessary to continue. Brian Jackson, Vancouver's general manager of planning, explained that there would be new public hearings held on the rules for the city's practice of giving developers extra density in exchange for social housing. Jackson added that when the city brings forward the new development permit and rezoning hearing, they would feature increased transparency and communication with residents.
In other Vancouver news, city councillors have commissioned an independent study over a possible pay raise. This Tuesday, the Vancouver City Council appointed an independent commission to review the salaries of Vancouver City Council members and the salaries of employees in other levels of jurisdiction to determine whether or not council members should receive a pay raise. Vision Vancouver councillor Jeff Max explained that the work of the city's elected officials has increased with the rise of email and social media as an essential but time-consuming form of communication with constituents. He said, quote, "If a raise is appropriate, I will take a raise. But we're gonna to ask an independent third party to take a look at the new duties that are emerging at the council and some of the pressures to see if whether a change is warranted." Mayor Gregor Robertson occurred in a statement where he said, quote, "Certainly with email, with cell phones, with social media, and with the engagement we need around the city and the neighborhoods, it's important that there is an independent look at compensation." The mayor currently receives a salary of more than $154,000 per year, less than Toronto Mayor John Tory at $177,000 and Calgary Mayor Nahid Nash at $216,000. Vancouver councillors currently earn just under $68,000 per year, while other councillors in the Greater Vancouver area typically earn half of their downtown counterparts. For instance, Abbotsford City councillors earn $33,000 per year. By contrast, Toronto and Calgary councillors rank in well above $100,000 each year. In response to some critics of a wage increase, the commission will also review whether or not councillors could hand off more of their duties to staff. As Green Party councillor Adrian Carr explained, quote, "Right now, as councillors, we share staff, and those staff are not due any direct correspondence for that reason. I get the phone calls from people who say, why is no one answering my questions? Why is nobody getting back to me? And that's what I want to address. The commission's report is expected in June.
In national news, conservatives pass controversial anti-terrorism bill. Last Friday, the federal government tabled Bill C-51, Canada's new anti-terrorism act, designed to increase the power of federal authorities to prevent and dismantle terrorist activity. The bill is the latest in a slew of anti-terrorist legislation proposed in the wake of the attack on Parliament Hill in October. However, much of the bill's content and impact is being kept secret. Typically, even when the government doesn't want to expose a bill to criticism, journalists will be allowed to read the bill for the purposes of staying informed and asking relevant questions during a bill's briefing. These journalists will then be made to sign an embargo on publishing the information they have learned until after the government's announcement. By contrast, journalists at the briefing for Bill C-51 were informed that they would not be permitted to view the bill. Instead, they were told to use a backgrounder document that would provide almost no new information. In response, attending journalists have voiced their concerns about the lack of transparency and access to the bill's contents, which largely remain a mystery. Journalists were also quick to criticize the question and answer period, accusing officials of providing scripted responses. Government staffers have since denied claims that the period was scripted. What we do know about the bill is that it seeks to broaden the powers of the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service and expand the list of indictable crimes related to terrorism, without doing very much to limit or keep those powers in check. For instance, under the new laws, the advocation or promotion of terror will become a criminal offense. However, the bill's definition of what constitutes terror advocacy or promotion has not yet been clarified. In his speech to introduce the new legislation, Stephen Harper justified this new classification of crimes by asserting that, quote, jihadist terrorism is not a future possibility. It is a present reality. BC Civil Liberties Association representative Michael Vaughan responded to the speech by saying, quote, criminalizing people's words and thoughts is misguided and won't make Canadians safer. Even Edward Snowden, NSA whistleblower currently living in Russia, cautioned Canadians during a live stream talk at Upper Canada College. Quote, I would say we should always be extraordinarily... Sorry about that. Lost my place. Excuse me one moment. I would say we should always be extraordinarily cautious when we see governments trying to set up a new secret police within their own countries. Prime Minister Harper rebuffed those criticisms, saying, quote, every time we talk about security, critics suggest that somehow our freedoms are threatened. I think what Canadians understand is that their freedoms and security more often than not go hand in hand. Some critics agree with Harper, saying that Canadians know their rights and know how to defend them against abuse. Ultimately, the wording of the laws remain unclear, with the bill being kept quiet by the government. Information is scarce, but it appears as though Bill C-51 will lower the standards of evidence needed to obtain warrants and will give police the authority to increase the amount of time someone suspected of terrorist activity can be detained without charge.
John Baird to step down as Foreign Affairs Minister. On Tuesday, Conservative MP John Baird announced his registration as Foreign Affairs Minister in what many consider to be a sudden turn of events. Among those surprised are the Prime Minister and Baird's political colleagues. In an interview with CBC's Peter Mansbridge, Baird said he wants to avoid becoming a political lifer and that he will be leaving politics to pursue a career in the private sector. Quote, I've always thought it's good to come in, make a contribution, and move on to something else. I did that 10 years ago at Queen's Park, and I'm doing the same now. Another key factor appears to be the death of Baird's longtime friend and colleague James Flaherty, who passed away only a month after stepping down as Canada's longtime finance minister. In regards to Flaherty's passing, Baird said, quote, It really shook me up, and it was a reminder that if we want to do other things and opportunities present themselves, you should reflect on that. Baird has denied rumors of a rift between him and the Prime Minister, or that his waning influence inside cabinet was the reason for his decision. As an interim replacement, Trade Minister Ed Fast will be filling Baird's role as Foreign Affairs Minister. Coming just months before the party tries for a fourth consecutive mandate, Baird's departure may be a significant blow for Conservatives.
Supreme Court of Canada strikes down ban on physician-assisted death. In a historic and unprecedented decision, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled unanimously to nullify the current prohibition on physician-assisted death. The decision will take effect in 12 months' time. Parliament will have 1 year to draft new legislation which grants the right of clearly consenting adults who are enduring intolerable suffering, physical or mental, to seek medical help ending their lives. The Supreme Court's decision is based on the current law's infringement of Section 7 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which has provisions stipulating the life, liberty, and security of Canadians. The decision reverses the top court's 1993 ruling in the case of Sue Rodriguez, with the court attributing the reverse decision to changing jurisprudence and an altered social landscape. Two BC women and their families have been credited with spurring the Supreme Court's reversal on physician-assisted suicide. One of these women, Gloria Taylor, suffered from ALS for several years. Despite having won her court case for a physician-assisted death, she died as the result of a painful infection caused by a perforated colon. The other BC woman, Kay Carter, was diagnosed with spinal stenosis, a degenerative condition that eventually confined her to a wheelchair, preventing her ability to feed herself or to go to the bathroom without aid. Carter experienced chronic pain as a result of her illness and traveled to Switzerland, where assisted suicide is legal, to die with dignity. In a statement, Kay Carter's daughter and lead plaintiff in the current court case said, quote, "As a woman who always enjoyed a debate, Kay would smile about this outcome and the conversation it has initiated about death and end-of-life options. Justice, dignity, and compassion were defining qualities of my mother. This ruling now extends those same elements to individuals seeking a dignified death. A huge victory for Canadians and a legacy for Kay. Thank you, Mom." However, due to the issue's divisive ethical and legal natures, there is considerable opposition to the Supreme Court's decision. Taylor Hyatt of the Euthanasia Prevention Council stated, quote, "The ruling actually wants people with disabilities to end their lives when they believe their suffering and the condition doesn't have to be terminal. From my point of view, all legal protection has been stripped." The Evangelical Fellowship of Canada, or EFC, state on their website that, quote, "Euthanasia or assisted suicide is never a right or acceptable solution, which is rooted in their belief that all human life is precious." In their latest media release, the EFC said they are, quote, "deeply disappointed with the Supreme Court's decision." They elaborated further by saying, quote, "The court has ruled that in some circumstances, the killing of a person will be legal. Euthanasia has come to Canada."
Canadian regulator declines world's most expensive drug. Canada's drug price regulator takes a big stand against pharmaceutical giant Alexion Pharmaceuticals. Charges against the company have been to lower the cost of the drug, Soliris. This drug treats patients with a rare blood disease known as paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, PNH, which affects about 180 patients in Canada alone. The yearly cost for a patient to be treated with Soliris is as high as $700,000 and has a reputation of being one of the most expensive drugs ever marketed. In 1 year, Soliris have ranked in over $2 billion in revenue for the pharmaceutical company and has boosted the aggregate valuation of the company based on its current share price and the total number of outstanding stocks to $35 billion. The Patented Medicines Price Review Board, PRB, has not held an executive price hearing since 2012, but has recently made formal allegations against Alexion for breaking federal rules that require drug price in Canada to be no more than the median, in other words, midpoint, of seven other industrialized countries. The PBM-PRB wrote in a staff document, quote, Alexion continues to sell salaries to Canadians at the highest international price among the comparator countries. The company denies that it has broken any federal rules and has refused to lower drug prices. However, a board adjudication panel is scheduled to be held no later than March 6th to investigate the legitimacy of claim made by both sides and if the vertigo finds the price of salaries excessively high, a cost reduction and repayment of surplus income may be in order.
Those are your campus, local, and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
I'm going to be round my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub.
It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a bee, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have a radio essay by Elizabeth Holliday about Sexual Assault Awareness Month and the politics of rape culture.
This January marked UBC's 7th annual Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Sexual Assault Awareness Month, or SAM, is a month-long campaign hosted through the Partnership of Access and Diversity, along with key shareholders, including the Sexual Assault Support Center. SAM was started in 2009 in response to a need to start community dialogues about sexualized violence at UBC, but in the past 7 years, the discussion has grown larger. The month is filled with a variety of events, including panels, workshops, discussions, and film screenings. And while sexual assault is the overarching theme, events such as this year's Bar Talk on Feminism in the Media through Terry Talks focus on different intersecting movements and discussions related to the prevalence, conditions, and stigmas around sexual assault. Working from a distinctly feminist framework, events throughout the month dealt with wide-ranging subjects from transformative justice to punk music. The range of these topics point to the relevance and necessity for an event like SAM, which is essentially about raising awareness and providing education for individuals, encouraging them to take personal responsibility to combat the common narratives disseminated about sexual assault. One of the main reasons why SAM is so important is that there is a lot of ambiguity about sexual assault. A major contributing factor of this uncertainty relates to an apparent societal fear of instigating or carrying out discussions about it in a public space. Because of the lack of earnest conversations about sexual assault and its related issues, it is also subject to rampant misdefinition. A starting place for these important conversations is therefore grounded in a common definition of the issue at hand. The SAM website defines sexual assault as any unwanted sexual contact, from unwanted contact to forced sexual intercourse, including the threat of sexual contact without consent. Consent itself is one of the thorniest issues in sexual assault cases, as can be seen across arenas from public news, as in the case of Jan Gomeshi, to daily interactions and conversations. Ambiguity about what truly defines consent and a lack of stress on the importance of it is an unignorable contributing factor to the prevalence of sexual assault and to the frequency of assaulters evading justice. The term is also explicitly defined on SAM's website as a voluntary and enthusiastic yes needed for every sexual activity. And very importantly, the consent can be revoked at any time. But even when these terms are fully understood, sexual assault and consent are not issues that are talked about in a public space with much frequency. This can be because of personal discomfort with the subject, shame about incidents of assault as a result of social stigma, and because of the widespread assumption that sexual assault doesn't happen or happen often. But this couldn't be further from the truth. 15 to 25% of female students and 6% of male students in college and university experience some sort of sexual assault. This means that in the average class of 30 people, 8 of your female classmates and 2 of your male classmates will have been sexually assaulted at least once. On the wider scale, 1 in 4 women will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. These statistics are only taken from the numbers to which we have access, however, because only 6 out of 100 incidents of sexual assault are ever reported to the police. This is not surprising, seeing as victim blaming and disbelief are the most commonly heard and disseminated reactions to sexual assault allegations, especially in high-profile cases. This past year alone, examples can be seen in the cases of Woody Allen, Jen Gomeshi, and Bill Cosby. There is a commonly circulated idea that those making allegations of sexual assault are liars. In truth, only 1 to 2% of sexual assault reports are false, which is the same as in other major forms of crime, such as theft. Of the approximately 460,000 sexual assaults in Canada every year, only 3 out of 1,000 assailants are ever convicted. In order to understand why this disbelief and flippant attitude towards sexual assault and the survivors of it is so widespread, it is necessary to understand something known as rape culture. This year's final keynote was popular YouTube vlogger and public sex educator Lacey Green, who gave a talk entitled Taking Down Rape Culture. It would be difficult to find a more appropriate endnote, as rape culture is possibly the greatest contributing factor, not only to the pervasiveness of sexual assault, but to the difficulty of stopping it. The term refers to a culture in which society blames victims of sexual assault and normalizes male sexual violence. As defined on the website Force, rape culture includes jokes, TV, music, advertising, legal jargon, laws, words, and imagery that make violence against women and sexual coercion seem so normal that people believe that rape is inevitable. Rather than viewing the culture of rape as a problem to change, people in a rape culture think about the persistence of rape as just the way things are. In order to take down rape culture, as Green suggests, a lot of work has to be done. But it is through events like SAM, fostering complex and overlapping discussions, and doing active work in awareness raising, that such a monumental task begins to be possible. In order to stop sexual assault, we must understand why it happens. And in order to do that, we must understand the societal constructs and habits that create an environment that lets it happen practically unpunished. By hosting Sexual Assault Awareness Month, UBC's faculty and student teams are doing their part to contribute to this change. But ultimately, it is a dialogue which needs to be taken off campus and into our daily lives, starting with recognition of the undeniable fact that sexual assault does happen.
Thank you, Elizabeth. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from our city, Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have your AMS update by Maura Warburton, featuring an interview with AUS President Jenna O'Massey. about the AMS Student Court.
Hi, I'm Moira Warburton, and I am here with your AMS report for news at CITR in the week of February. Yesterday's meeting was on the 4th. So it was a really, really, really long meeting. Picture a long meeting and then lengthen it, and that's how long the AMS meeting was last night. First up was a presentation from UBC's community planning. They were talking about their vision for UBC. Huge, huge shocker. More construction. Basically, if it hasn't been constructed on, it will be. If it's already been constructed on, it probably will be. And everything else, you'll be rooted around. So, yeah, they're talking about a redesign for Westbrook Mall. They've got a lot of, like, open houses, public consultations, stuff like that, where you can get involved. The other thing that was a topic of conversation was that they're planning on putting faculty housing, like, in the middle of campus, which really touched a nerve with a lot of AMS counselors. There were a lot of questions, rather sassy questions. There were a lot of questions about this, like, namely, why do we need faculty housing in the middle of a campus that is already potentially lacking in community, like, student life? So, yeah, I don't understand it at all. I'm not going to try and justify it because I don't think it was justified. If you have opinions about this, you should get involved with, you can go to planning.ubc.ca, and they have, like, when all the open houses and stuff like that are. Then Chris Roach was there talking about the budget. They have $51,000 for block party, and that's the only number I heard that I felt feel comfortable quoting on air. There was a big sounding number for the deficit, but I'm not going to swear to that. But yeah, $51,000 for block parties. That's exciting. The Ombuds Office presented. The Ombuds person basically receives complaints related to the AMS. Her policy is conflict management over conflict resolution. She doesn't like the word resolution. She can break confidentiality if people are threatening harm to themselves, harm to others, or harm to minors. So if you go to the ombudsperson and you're talking about any of the above, she can break your confidentiality. Just an FYI, always here to help. That's basically all she had to say. The sub tweets. Ava was talking about the opening of the sub, and I was getting really excited because the sub will be opening. Like, I think April 10th is still the tentative, relatively firm day for opening. The perch and the daycare might not open at the same time as the main opening of the sub. She also said that basically when the sub opens, picture everything you could possibly want during finals, and that's what the sub will have. So that sounds awesome. Executive remarks, interesting things to note. Nasiri said, hopefully we will have an AMS sports advising committee to help the AMS make sports-related decisions. For the president's remarks, the most interesting part was that he'll be having dinner with Arvind because they are on first-name-term basis, like you are. Constituency reports, Arts will be having a second installment of the Coffee House because it was really successful the first time. In my notes, I have that I stopped paying attention for a while after Jenna said puppy day because I was really interested by that and was trying to find a good puppy gift for Twitter. If you don't already follow us on Twitter, you should. It's at CITR News. So the arts will be having a puppy day. Veronica Knott, president of the EUS, would like to note that the engineering faculty actually had this last year, but arts is doing it again. And yeah, that was basically it, because it was a really long meeting. They went in camera for an hour and a half, which is the longest in-camera session I've been through the entire time. It was really long, and it was really frustrating, because I'm assuming if it was that long of an in-camera session, they were talking about something interesting. After that, they talked about the student court, because the LPC had recommendations on how the student court should be brought back into the AMS and brought back into a working order. But I will be talking to Jenna about that right after this. That is your AMS update. So I'm here with Jenna Omasi, president of the AUS, and what is your position on the LPC exactly?
I'm the chair of the Legislative and Procedures Committee of the AMS.
So that is what?
So that committee deals with all, I guess, internal workings of the AMS. We deal with all changes to the Code of Procedures, to bylaws, and to internal policies. So anything that changes within the AMS has to go through the Legislative and Procedures Committee.
Such as the student court, which is what you were talking about last night.
Yes. So among many changes that came to AMS Council last night, we had code changes for the student court that LPC has been working on for a couple of weeks now.
So what exactly is the student court? Like, what is its role within the AMS?
So the student court is actually a body that's in bylaws. So it's a body that, unless a referendum of the student body is held and students vote to take it out of bylaws, it's a body that needs to be hired for and around in the AMS. And what it essentially does is it's there as a body for council and for committees to defer to for things such as removing ambiguities, doing interpretations of bylaws, code, and policies. So if there's any questions, instead of reverting back to the Speaker of Council or Clerk of Council, you can go to Student Court, and it's a body that is supposed to be there to act as a resource to council.
So why haven't we had, or why are we doing this rehiring now? Why hasn't the Student Court been working for the last 5 years, I believe you said?
Yes. So the last time Student Court was used was in 2009. And at that time, Student Court had made a number of rulings, and they were quite controversial. And of the five of the last rulings that they had made, four had gone to council, and AMS Council has said no to them. So all rulings have to go to AMS Council before they're passed, and essentially council was not comfortable passing any of them. And at that time, what council decided was that the student court wasn't functioning as they had needed it to. It actually wasn't fulfilling its function as being a resource to council. And because it was in bylaws, it was technically a body that they couldn't remove. So council and the executive just decided to stop hiring for it, which technically is not supposed to be done. And so every year since then, there's been a discussion of student court. And this year, Tanner Booker, who's AMS president, brought up in the summer that it was something that either needed to be changed in code or needed to be hired as is. But because of our workload and how big it is, we just got to it now. And so what we did was we looked at the code of procedures and we cut out all the pieces that had been put in there, making it such an inefficient and intricate body, and really stripped it down to what it's supposed to be, which is
so
a resource to council.
What were some of the things that it didn't need to be?
So, for example, there were a bunch of committees that stemmed off of student court that were there to appeal decisions and make different decisions. There was a prosecutor and a prima facie and essentially positions in there that made it much more complicated than it had to be. Additionally, the makeup of the student court made it so that students who were on the student court, who were all judges, they were called judges and were all law students, actually thought that they were in a real court setting, though that is not exactly what student court is supposed to do. It's supposed to act as a resource. So in taking away a prosecutor and leaving judges who are going to be chosen from across campus, different constituencies, making it a much more representative body, we're hoping that it can be something that's hired for and that need be, if it needs to be used, can be used effectively, and AMS Council can then accept the proper rulings of the council.
So how do you see it functioning in the AMS in the future? Like, what kind of rulings will be passed down? When will we go to the council, or to the court, sorry?
Yeah, so right now there's essentially, though it's a little more complicated than that, there's essentially two times that one can go or refer to student court. So one is to make clarifications and remove ambiguities. That's either interpreting code or ambiguities in referendum questions, ambiguities in anything essentially in council, and that can come from council or the legislative procedures committee. The other time is in disciplinary cases, though we don't expect that to be used. So really it is for providing a resource to, especially to the legislative procedures committee. If there's anything that we're unsure about, we can refer to them and they can give us a ruling as to what they think bylaws or code says, but also ambiguities that council can point to. So with elections coming up, in case referendums come up that are ambiguous and the questions themselves need to be reviewed, the only body right now that can do that is student court. And so not having them hired is a little bit problematic, just because you never know what's going to come.
Yeah. So basically the fact that it's being reviewed and being put into place as a more functioning institution is definitely a good thing.
Absolutely. And it's something that hasn't happened for 5 years, which is problematic. So when people have asked why now, it's not a conversation that has just started.
Yeah.
We've been having this conversation for months. It's just that now more than ever, we might need it. So why not hire for a body that should have been around for the last 5 years?
Well, congratulations on getting the motions passed last night.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Thanks, no worries. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Moira. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
CITR would like to congratulate Surrey's Ekamjeet Gooman, the recipient of this year's People's Choice Award for the World Cerebral Palsy Day Change the World in 1 Minute campaign, led by Cerebral Palsy Alliance. Cerebral palsy is a debilitating neuromotor condition that affects movement, muscle control, and balance, and occurs in 1 out of every 500 births. Ekamjeet, an SFU student who lives with cerebral palsy, proposed the idea of featuring models with the condition in advertising campaigns, which was voted the most popular idea by cerebral palsy associations all around the world. The Cerebral Palsy Association of British Columbia believes that such advertisements will provide much-needed public awareness for this condition, which is often misunderstood or misrecognized. By increasing public awareness, it hopes to see all who live with cerebral palsy participate fully in our community. For more information about the Cerebral Palsy Association of BC, which has supported the cerebral palsy community for over 60 years, please visit www.bccerebralpalsy.com. For more info about the World Cerebral Palsy Day, please visit www.worldcpday.org.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have Marco updating us on all of the newest science and tech news.
Good afternoon. It's Friday, February 6th, and this is the Science and Technology News on CITR.
It must be true, because I heard it on the radio. It must be true, it must be true.
In our lead story, NASA is describing a little worm as something small that comes in a good package. In this case, NASA is referring to an earthworm called Canor habditatus elegans C. This is an earthworm that NASA will transport to the International Space Station on February 15th. Astronauts that are involved on long space missions or who stay for extended periods of time on the International Space Station very often suffer muscle atrophy and bone loss. This also occurs to the elderly or the infirm on Earth who are bedridden or who have muscular diseases. NASA will try to use an earthworm called Canor habditatus elegans C and see how the effects of microgravity on the space station will compare to earthworms that are grown in a lab in Japan. In particular, these worms will be studied, their exoskeletons and their muscular system will be studied to see how microgravity of space affects their muscles and whether these worms can mutate and evolve and possibly pass on stronger muscular systems to other generations of earthworms that are born in space. In this research, NASA hopes to find treatments or medicines that can benefit not only astronauts that are involved on long-term missions, but also patients that are suffering on Earth. In another story, the Pineapple Express is coming. NASA's National Organization of Aeronautics, their GEOS satellite, is tracking a weather system called the Pineapple Express. The Pineapple Express originates in Hawaii, and it is moving toward what is called the Pacific Northwest and southern BC. The Pineapple Express brings with it heavy rain, possibly snow for higher elevations, but the main feature is there's a lot of moisture in the warm air. This will benefit California, which has suffered through a long 2-year drought. The Pineapple Express will first hit Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia, then move down to Northern California and the rest of California. This isn't a permanent solution for the drought in California, but it will bring much needed relief to the drought-stricken area. In our third story called Dance of the Nanovortices. So what is a nanovortice? A nanovortice, also called a skimmeron, is a little magnetic entity that is created when different layers of material, very thin material, are brought together and a magnetic field is applied. In this particular research, cobalt-boron alloy and platinum layers of material that are 1 nanometer thick were stacked on top of each other and a magnetic field was applied. Scientists watched as the little magnetic entities were created. Previously, scientists thought that the nanovortices lacked mass, but now they have noticed that these nanovortices spin like a top would spin. If the nanovortices have mass, they can act as storage mediums in the layers in between these different alloys and can provide high-tech applications to store data or transfer data at a much higher level. In our fourth story, something that concerns British Columbia. The CBC News has reported that bitumen spill effects on waterways, oceans, is still unknown, so says a draft report. CBC has reported that the Harper government has been hiding this report and did not make it public. But the Greenpeace Foundation forced the report out in the open through the Freedom of Information Act. Industry and government officials have been claiming there is no danger to the environment or there are no toxicological dangers with the transport of oil from the oil sands to the coast of British Columbia. But the NDP and the Greenpeace Foundation have raised concerns. NDP environment critic Megan Leslie on Monday said, and quote, "If this report has been around since 2013 and it has not been released until now, it makes me think that the government must be trying to hide something." Greenpeace had said the toxicological research on bitumen and its effect on the environment have not been studied. But Francis Pear, the president of the Trans-Canada Energy Pipeline, is downplaying the report. He says, and quote, "There are no reliable third-party or scientific studies that have demonstrated that diluted bitumen behaves just like any other crude oil product that's transported through our pipelines." Philippe Riker of the Canadian Pipeline Association echoes this opinion. Generally speaking, he says, and quote, "No operational evidence indicates that diluted bitumen behaves differently than other forms of crude oil. The bitumen is necessary in the extraction of oils from the oil sands." But Keith Stewart from Greenpeace said, and quote, "Prime Minister Harper is approving the Northern Gateway pipeline in spite of important knowledge gaps that now exist with the dangers of bitumen. The fact that they're saying full speed ahead, even though they know it's a lot more dangerous than they've been letting on to publicly, should be cause for concern. It throws into question the regulatory approval process when they withhold this kind of information. In the report, there is 10 specific knowledge gaps about the danger of bitumen to the environment if it's leaked into the ground or the sea to aquatic organisms. A better understanding is needed on the fate and behavior of these products, assessing potential risks to aquatic organisms." In the report, Venezuelan production of oil is referred to. 2/3 bitumen and 1/3 water, which is highly toxic, has been used in their pipelines. This mixture is 300 times more toxic than oil, and the embryos that have been exposed to this have been affected. Generally, Greenpeace and the NDP have said it is not known how bitumen reacts with sediments or whether it would float or sink. Research regarding how bitumen products will further biodegrade the environment is insufficient, or so concludes the NDP critic. This is Marco. You have been listening to the Science and Technology News on CITR 101.9.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Linda.
And I'm Rohit. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Up next on the program, we have a segment by Costa Costa, in which he spoke with members of UBC's Partywell Initiative, a new club on campus which intends to blend partying and charity.
Party Well is a UBC organization that wants you to party for a great cause. Proceeds from their events will go towards building wells in communities abroad. I spoke with co-founders James Cohen and Joe Lewis about their initiative.
Tell me about yourselves.
My name's James. Mm-hmm. I am a bit of an international student. I'm from Australia, France, and Italy. I spent 7 years in Japan. This is actually the place where I met this guy, Joe Luis, in sixth grade.
Long time ago.
We were good buddies, and on one not quite too sober evening coming home from Bagne, I actually bumped into him on a complete coincidence. I had no idea that he actually was going to this university. And yeah, it was a good time ever since. We've been doing little ventures together. And
cool.
Yeah.
So, as James introduced me, I'm Joseph Lewis. I'm a third-year commerce student here at UBC, and yep, my roots stem back from, I'm half English, half South African, but I've had the luxury of living all over the world, and one of those places was Tokyo, Japan, where then again, I did meet this guy, and it's grown into a sort of a sweet harmony of a relationship, especially here at UBC after all these years. but I'm very interested in, you know, in the end, making a bit of money is nice, but doing something for a change is even better.
Which brings me to Party Well, and can you explain for our listeners a little bit about Party Well?
Sure thing. So Party Well is a fundraising organization. It gives fundraising opportunities at entertainment events. So we offer people the opportunity to meet up with a bunch of their friends and have a really great time and actually make a difference in the world while they're doing it. We are Water Project based. All of the proceeds from our events goes through Free the Children in order to fund the development of water projects in countries such as Kenya. This upcoming event, Future Fest, that we're doing, we'll be funding an area called Kipsongol in Kenya. This is actually an area that I had the opportunity to visit last summer, which is actually a really inspiring experience for me. I got to interact and communicate with a lot of people who have to spend many, many hours bringing water back to their villages. For some people, this is the longest activity that they're doing in their entire day, and it's a big barrier for a lot of people, and I think it's a barrier that we can break down to some extent with some really awesome parties.
So where did the idea of Party Well come from?
So, well, last year, back in around February, I was convinced by a friend to go to a Free the Children meeting, and they had actually been approached by a promoter from a downtown nightclub saying that if we were to promote for an event that was coming up, then they would give us half of all the ticket revenues that they would sell. And we were able to negotiate such that we could keep all of the ticket revenues that we could sell and donate that to our cause, which was a water project. And this visual software that I was very interested in at the time, it was actually right there on the homepage saying that if you want to use this technology for a fundraising event, then you'll get an extremely discounted rate. And so we got a really good rate on that, and that was when the sort of light bulb ticked on for me and Joe as well. That we can create some really great experiences with a really cool production and actually get a lot of people involved in it very quickly. And that's sort of how this organization sparked. And many people wanted to get involved because at the end of the day, it is a really fun thing to do. And also volunteering for it is a great experience and it enables a lot of people to actually make a difference
right.
while doing that.
Was this a collaboration between you two right from the get-go?
Yes. So the first I heard was I was actually skiing one weekend and I got a call and I was like, hey. And James goes, social venture this, social venture that. And I'm just like, hey, I'm skiing now. But remember, early bird gets the worm. And a few days later when I got back, the ball had already started rolling. And the reason why all of a sudden the spark had, you know, actually turned into a flame was that people didn't just go, oh, you know, can I come to your event? But they go, how can I help? Mm-hmm. Because when it's not just partying, but you're doing something that is, you know, it doesn't, the money you give doesn't just go into someone's pocket for cover, for example. Mm-hmm. That money was going, the 100% of the proceeds were going to building a well in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
And
thank you, Costa. For the rest of the interview, please visit News 101 SoundCloud page. That's our program for today, February 6th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@crtr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, crtr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Linda.
And I'm Rohit. Today's broadcast was produced by Marko Prodanovic from the entire news team at CITR. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM. To close off the show, we have the number 2 album on our charts this week,
Bonnie State of Mind. This is Comfortable Conversation by Freak Heatwave.